so begin.
There is a hole in your mind.
What do you want?
No one here is exactly what he appears.
Nothing's the same anymore.
Commander Sinclair is being reassigned.
Why don't you eliminate the entire non-holy?
I see a great hand reaching out of the stars.
Who are you?
President Clark has signed a decree today declaring
martial
law.
These orders have forced us to declare independence.
Weapons
and supplies. That's why people get off their encounter-suited butts and do something.
You are the one who watches.
To Zahadu, who will die.
Why are you here? Do you have anything worth living for?
Think of my beautiful city of flames.
Giants in the playground.
Get the hell out of our galaxy!
We are here to place President Clark under arrest.
Hello and welcome to Chats, a television podcast, Season 6, Chatsalon 5. My name is Alan, and though I mourn for my own people, in all my life, I don't think I've ever felt more pity in my life for anyone than I do him. It's Magellan, everyone.
Hey.
Man.
Hey. I'm doing fine. You don't have to feel bad for me.
He's talking about Londo in that scene, right? That's like the Jakar to Londo, am I correct, or no?
I don't even remember that quote at all, to be honest. Yeah, I think it is. You're right.
It makes the most sense.
Jakar's talking about Londo. I don't remember who he's talking to in that scene, but yeah, he's like, I miss that guy.
Yeah, I miss that guy.
Really down. Really bummed out. That was... we'll talk about the Londo plot first. There was a scene... We're at the end where Sheridan's like, woof, where's that guy? I feel bad for him.
He's probably getting drunk. He's probably still celebrating, having a great time.
Cut to the same, like, slow back away shot of Londo just getting crusty on the throne that we've seen in all our nightmares.
As if the cameraman is afraid to walk in on him.
Yeah.
Just so ginger, and he's just the most sad, and it's empty, and... there's nobody to help him anymore. That's where Londo's at, everyone. It's a fun TV show that we watch here.
Yeah, so that was Londo's plot, and I think we're good, right?
That's basically the gist of what happened this week.
So yeah. We can just kind of hang out for the next couple hours or so.
Yeah. Any good recipes you tried recently?
Well, no.
You live in New York where no one has time to cook. That's fair.
Yeah, I ordered some pad see ew with shrimp tonight. That was pretty tasty.
I'll pad see ew later.
Oh, pad see ew in me now. Get you and me inside me.
What?
Food.
Oh, food. Okay.
Yeah, get your food inside me.
I just want to say, I don't think it's necessary. I'm going to change topics for a sec. I don't think it's necessarily bad.
Oh, you can change it forever.
But eventually it does have to go back to TV, theoretically, maybe?
Oh. I thought we were talking about pad see ew with shrimp.
Oh, pad see ew with shrimp. So I've never had pad see ew. I've only had pad thai. I should get pad see ew at some point.
Pad see ew is better, in my opinion. Pad thai, it's always like the peanuts, it's an interesting thing, but people put too many peanuts on there.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Did you know that too many cooks just turned like 5?
No. That actually, I thought you were going to say 10.
No, 2014, I believe.
Well, that's great then.
I think it aired originally on Adult Swim at like 3 in the morning, and then they just put it on YouTube. What a weird thing. I rewatched it and I was like, this is still a little funny. It's like a little funny.
There was a whole discourse cycle about how genius that was.
Yeah.
And I like don't ever need to watch it again.
No.
Because I feel like I'm only going to have a lower impression of it.
Right. It really sold itself on the mystery. And like as soon as you know that, it's just like, okay. And... It's in a similar box in my head as Don't Hug Me, I'm Scared. Have you heard of that before?
I've heard of it. I don't think I've watched it.
It's actually a series. The first one was kind of like Too Many Cooks, where it billed itself as like fun puppet show, and then it's actually not that. Mm-hmm. But now they're on, I think someone was telling me, the 7th one? And it's like they just went the route of horror movies, where it's like we had a good idea, and now we're just like spinning into the grave, basically.
I gotta say about Too Many Cooks, the fact that there's a murderer is not funny to me.
No, it's the fact that the murder, like, it's A, the part where the show keeps changing. Like, it's playing in the DNA of a TV show, which I think is relevant to what we talk about here. And it, like, becomes like a sci-fi show at one point.
Yeah, the funniest part to me is that weird insert shot of, like, the eagle flying when it becomes, like, the daytime soap opera opening or whatever.
Right. I forget which show that's specifically trying to parody, but the fact that it does it like 7 times where it keeps cutting back to the eagle. And then, yeah, the part where it's just like a slasher film is just like boring. It's like, yeah,
whatever. It's so boring. Like, this isn't a great twist. This is dumb.
I think the parts where it gets glitchy are also funny. But that's our 2019 Too Many Cooks relitigation.
Yeah, go ahead, watch it, check it out. That's gonna be our next show, Cooks Chats.
Yeah, Cooks Chats. We're just gonna watch Oh my God, we're gonna watch Too Many Cooks one time a week.
Two cooks a week.
Yeah, we're gonna watch it two times a week and talk about it.
That's not what we're doing now, though. We got to finish this show first.
This whole mess of a series.
Oh God, boy,
So we're talking about Babylon 5, folks. We watch two episodes of this show every week, and this week we watched season 5, episode 19, "The Wheel of Fire." We also watched season 5, episode 20, "Objects in Motion." First, we're going to talk about "The Wheel of Fire," which was written by J. Michael Straczynski. It was directed by Janet Greek and aired November 4th, 1998. And it takes place from August 19th to the 21st of 22, 62. Now, Magellan, my friend, I want to ask you what happens in The Wheel of Fire.
Bro, I could cry. That's like, that's the second to last time you're going to say 22 is 62.
I can just say it to you and like record it for you or something. Bro, I am recording it right now. Hold on.
I genuinely almost teared up when I heard you say that.
62. I love ending shows.
Oh God!
I can just say it as much as you want. 2262.
No,
it's right there.
No, stop! It's not the same.
Oh boy! Oh, I'm sorry.
I think I'm gonna cry.
I'm absolutely gonna cry during Sleeping in Light. I'm like ready.
Holy crap! In this episode, Jakar deals with the cult of personality forming around him. Delenn learns that she's pregnant. Lockley helps Garibaldi deal with his problems with alcoholism. Alan, what'd you think of The Wheel of Fire?
I love that this is the episode that the season is titled, is matching the title of the season.
What a weird choice, by the way, but yeah, continue.
Right, this isn't like the beginning of the arc, this is sort of like an interim episode, but I really, really, really liked this one. We're basically just firing on all cylinders, Babylon 5-wise, this week. A lot of really strong character moments. It feels like... yes, I'm gonna be more sad that the show is going to end because it's not ending on like a triumph. It doesn't seem like it's going to end on like a triumphant battle. There's no way anymore.
We're done with that. Yeah,
we had all of those. You know, we had our like Sheridan almost crashes a ship onto Earth, and we had our like the people fly over Centauri Prime. Like all of that has happened and gone, and now it's just time for people to talk to each other.
Yeah.
Even Star Trek The Next Generation ended on like a big battle thing.
It's kind of interesting that probably the last big battle that we'll see in the main series was like a really bad thing that happened. It was like this avoidable trick played by the Drak, and it's not like a, oh my God, everything's ruined, and also not like a, we did it, but more like a, ugh. We almost had it. Everything was fine.
You want a war, you got a war.
Up. That's the feeling that Babylon 5 is like leaving its military strand of its identity with. Like, ugh, that didn't need to happen.
And what's fascinating is as you're watching characters realize that they've been responsible for so much of that stuff. And like come to terms with their own faults. And I think one of the beautiful things about where I think this final arc is going is that it's less about how do we wrap up conflict, and it's like, how do we live? Like, what is our purpose in life now that we have irrevocably changed the universe in a lot of ways for the worse? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't feel like anyone is ending clean right now. Like, it feels like everyone is picking up the pieces of the ruins and saying, well, this is what I can deal with. This is the hand that fate dealt me and that I dealt myself. How can I take this in a place where I can, like, end my life in a good way?
Right.
And that's so beautiful and so powerful, and it permeates every single scene in I think both of these episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Just this like dread that like the end is coming. What can we bring with us to the promised land, you know, and what does that look like?
Right.
We opened on a really interesting pairing that you commented on to me. Lockley and Jakar talking about life and pity and Londo and all that stuff. Yeah.
So I think back in the day, we would use this phrase a lot that we sort of coined between the two of us when we were watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yeah.
Which is, I don't remember. We've sort of called it like Whedon's Law or the Whedon Test or whatever.
Right, right.
But basically this idea that like the mark of a really strong ensemble is you could pair any two characters from that ensemble and get an interaction or a scene that like couldn't possibly occur between any two other characters and is like meaningful and characterful and really interesting. And so these two episodes that we watched, and presumably the next one as well, is just a kind of masterclass in those types of scenes.
Yeah.
It starts, I guess the first one is, I said this when I was texting you about it, a little weird because Jakar and Lockley are treating each other as if they're friends. And it's like, when have you ever spoken to each other in this show? Jakar is saying, oh, thank you, my old friend. And Lockley, you know, says, well, it wanted you to hear it from me first or whatever. It's the affection is nice, but I guess they have been, you know, in the same place for a year. So it makes sense that they've had interactions that we haven't seen. But at least in terms of like the text of the show, it felt a little strange.
Yeah, so I think it could be a couple things. It could be the potentially it's Vonova was supposed to be Lockley, and this could have been a scene that was referred.
That would definitely feel correct if it was Vonova.
Totally. And then also like, yeah, this is a way to do world building where it's like, oh, these people do know each other. You just didn't see them hang out.
True.
Like, you don't need to, we always talk about on our show like how I wish these characters hung out more. I wish they had more scenes. And it's like all they need to really suggest is that they live full, fulfilling lives that we occasionally can look in on, but we're never going to see, like, you know, every time everyone hangs out.
Yeah. So I'm willing to accept that it is, like, in the fiction of the world making sense. It's just that as a scene, it was jarring because we almost never see Lockley. And then all of a sudden, she's, like, best friends with Jakar and best friends with Garibaldi. And what's going on?
Yeah, they're slotting her in weird ways.
But I did love the the surprise twist of Jakar saying, well, they must have all left, right? They must have gotten sick of me, forgot that I was even around. Turned the corner, and he just has throngs of worshippers bowing to him.
To be fair, we're both in this Jakar fan club. But yeah, they're a little obsessive.
100%, yeah.
It's like, it's kind of a running gag throughout these two episodes of like, Jakar, literally nobody can go talk to Jakar without wading through like 60 like obsessed Narn holding up statues in his image.
Yeah.
He's very uncomfortable by this, rightfully. And they even bow when he like raises his hands for them to stop, as if like he's Moses guiding the people or something.
Right.
The Narn are the Narn plot actually went more places than I expected, and I think it concluded really well here, but or in the second episode, but like, it's weird. It is really weird seeing, like, now he's frustrated because he's saying, like, I never wanted to be this martyr. I didn't want to be this religious figure. But, I mean, we're viewing him in the show as, like, the wisest character on this show right now. Like, honestly, yeah. I couldn't stop writing down every single thing that he said in these episodes. It actually got to the point, funnily enough, where I wrote in my notes, I really wish there was just a book of, like a book of Jakar, and then I was like, oh wait, no, that's, yep, okay, I'm these characters.
There
totally is. Yeah. And he wants to write another one, we learn later.
It's such a joy, you know, you very often get characters who are the wise character, but it's much more rare, I think, to be with them along the entire journey of them gaining pretty much all of their wisdom. Because if you were to compare this Jakar to the Jakar from The Gathering,
oh boy,
they are night and day, absolutely, completely different people. Because the Jakar from The Gathering is, you know, going to do whatever it takes to strike at the Centauri and lie, cheat, and steal his way to revenge. And this Jakar is just so world-weary and sick of all, any sort of fighting. And I found the rich irony in this episode that I really appreciated was that part of the reason the Narn are like obsessed with him right now is that, I don't remember who says this, but they believe that Jakar's presence on Centauri Prime, like, essentially gave them permission to attack the Centauri without getting in trouble.
Right, like he was a holy guiding guardian angel or something.
Yeah, because it's like they have our guys, so we're going to attack. And they got to use him as an excuse for violence.
Yeah.
And also they, like, didn't care. It's like, oh, you survived. That's a nice bonus. They didn't care if they had leveled the planet and he had died. Because at this point, the real-life Jakar is a liability for this movement that has been built up around him.
Yeah, exactly.
Because what they want now, and he talks to Dr. Franklin about this, and I adored the interaction between him and Franklin.
Yep.
Where they're talking about how it's so much easier to, like, buy the Jakar doll and say, look, I'm moral because I own the Jakar doll, instead of actually interrogating yourself and, you know, asking yourself if you're living in the way that Jakar would advise or the way that he's living.
Right.
Yeah.
It's very sad because, like you said, he doesn't need to be around anymore. His message has gone beyond him and has gone into the realm of, like, not even just Messiah, but, like, he's beyond, like, deity now. It's sort of like how in Deconstruction of Falling Stars we hear about, like, the savior, John Sheridan, and it's just like he's not the guy anymore. And Jakar is still alive to see that happen to him.
Yeah, and his message has been totally lost also. It's not even that his message is transcended. It nobody ever got it. He has just been turned into this, like, figurehead that people can invoke to justify whatever action they want to justify. The fact that he was alive when, in his name, the Narn people bombed Centauri Prime proves that his message has not stuck with a single person whatsoever. It's interesting to think about, like, JMS clearly loves to use Babylon 5 or has used Babylon 5 as a way to explore issues of religion and his own. I haven't listened to enough of his autobiography to understand his own relationship to faith and if he's a person of faith or not, but he's clearly very interested in exploring those issues of faith. And so you can extract a pretty present conversation from this Jakar plot about, like, the way that people think about or treat Jesus. Right?
Right.
Like, people literally have Jesus dolls and pictures of Jesus, and people have crucifixes around their neck that serve the purpose that the Jakar action figure serves of, like, look, I've got my guy here, so that means that I'm doing the right thing. And you have to imagine that JMS is, like, making a commentary on that.
Right, but this is what I think always has impressed me with Babylon 5's portrayal of religion is, unlike some other science fiction shows, and some other just television in general, I don't think it's saying that religion is, you know, bad. It can be wielded terribly by terrible people because it can be wielded to sort of justify bad actions, but it also gives certain people, like, a purpose in life, and it gives them a moral compass, and it gives them, you know, something to live for. Like, that's... It's very much not trying to, like, make a negative point, but it's just kind of like, hey, this is one way that a message can be corrupted, and it is sad, and we know that. Like, it works.
Yeah, it feels like very precise critiques that are being made, and it you know, Babylon 5 feels like a show, and we talked. I'm sort of reiterating a lot of points or bringing back things that we would talk about a lot in the early show, partly because I've been listening back through to all of Chats on 5, which is a wonderful experience for me, having not listened to all the episodes the first time around. Mm-hmm. But we would talk a lot about religion, and I think that the religion thing was hit more directly early in the show and then kind of put on the back burner, at least in the recent season. There wasn't a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not true. I don't know.
Well,
but it feels like we haven't talked about it in a while anyway.
I mean, this is a show that had in its first season an episode where all of the, like, religious dignitaries from every faith came onto the ship and, like, hung out.
Right. That's exactly what I'm thinking about. And we would talk a lot also about how Babylon 5 is a show about, like, why we can't have nice things.
Yeah.
And I think we would talk about that in the context of peace. But I think faith is also another one of these, this is why we can't have nice things kinds of things.
Yeah.
Because that's what this Jakar plot is about. This is why kind of blind idolatry or a following of religion that isn't interrogating itself, this is why it falls apart and ultimately becomes like a corrupted thing instead of the nice thing that we want it to be.
Right. And again, I think it even has something to say about like the way that we think about characters in our dramas and in our television shows, and how we want to view them as like, not deities necessarily, but like people to moral compasses for us, people to work towards. Like, I want to be like Superman. You know, the JMS himself has said that was like what inspired him to keep living after a lot of like a horribly abusive childhood. It's like, I want to be like Superman. I want to be a hero to someone. And I see Jakar, and I think, man, I really wish I could do some of these things. I could say some of these things and have the sort of mental clarity that he has. Mm. And what he's saying is like, you need to be your own person. Like, the only way for the Narn to advance as a society and not fall prey to, like you said, idolatry and this sort of like religious ignorance and complacence is for him to leave and never come back.
Mm.
That's why he dips at the end of the second episode. Is he's like, they need to figure this out. They can't have me anymore. I'm not telling them. Like, I'm leaving, and they need to just develop themselves.
Yeah.
It's a really
make the mistake or not.
Yeah. Exactly. It's sort of like, what if the Vorlons in the shadows, instead of like interfering, were like, what if we just didn't?
Yeah.
You know, right. What if we left? Yeah, it's a great scene. We'll come back to it. I kind of want to go through this episode slowly because. Okay, there's sure. Just a lot of scenes. Most of it actually involves Garibaldi. He's sort of one of the other star of this episode. I think we are taking his alcoholism plot in really interesting directions, because at the start of this episode, he's completely wasted, and mm-hmm. he gets a call from Franklin who says the meeting is at 2:00. He says, I thought it was at 4:00. And he's like, no, dude, it's at 2:00. It's 2:10. Like, get your ass out. He goes to the meeting. Sheridan immediately knows what's going on and asks him to like deliver his messages for the council. And he does what we used to do, where he gets like the Minbari and the Centauri mixed up.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, Minbari, Centauri, just fuck. And then Sheridan just immediately is like, you're drunk. This meeting is over. Everybody get out. And like the absolute dad that he is, he's like, Michael, stay. Take a seat. You're not going anywhere. That's a really weird way to end a cold open. Also, it's just like, oh, huh.
Yeah, like, okay, yeah, we're doing the plot. We're not gonna have any more episodes that ominously end with Garibaldi's hand like dangling above a bottle, and then like the bottle winks at you or whatever. we're done doing that. I was surprised that it was that direct and that public,
right?
And I was thankful for it, because the Sheridan Garibaldi scene that follows. It almost cracked me in half. It was so beautiful and genuine.
Yeah, I think all of the scenes where people try to talk to Garibaldi in this episode are powerful in that way. He kind of brings that out in people, though, because he's always been the heart of Babylon 5. People talk about that. They're like, he's like the guy who's there when you aren't. Like, he's been here longer than anyone else.
True, yeah.
He knows what's going on, and like that's why we expect better from him. And I did like kind of think that Sheridan was being a little bit parental here, saying the classic, I'm not angry with you, I'm disappointed. But it kind of works. I mean, he's trying to guilt Garibaldi. I think it's interesting, too, to compare how Sheridan reprimands Garibaldi versus how Lockley reprimands him. I think these are two very distinct and important ways that people can kind of start interventions with those with addiction problems.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that Sheridan is showing a much more like relaxed and calm demeanor, maybe because of Delenn, maybe because of just like the endless stress of the bigger scale like wars that are happening. So that now, when it's just like one of my best friends is, his alcoholism is causing him problems in life, that's actually like not a difficult thing for him to handle. He's like, yep, I can do this. Like,
yeah,
this is actually relatively easy.
I think an important distinction to clarify about, like, I'm not angry, I'm just disappointed.
Yeah,
is he's not disappointed in Garibaldi. He's disappointed in himself.
Right.
Because he basically says to Garibaldi, like, I knew this was happening. It was obvious.
We knew for a while, and I kept lying to myself.
You were showing up late, and you were doing worse at your job. And he mentions when he wasn't able to help Franklin with his stim addiction. And I was like, oh, shit.
Oh, fuck.
I forgot about that. But yeah.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Oh, man.
The show doesn't put any plot down for good.
Yeah. And I think the reason that Sheridan is being so kind to Garibaldi, like, it's not necessarily the best thing for someone in the situation to, like, make it about you.
Yeah.
And say, I'm not mad at you, man. I'm just disappointed in myself that you didn't trust me. It's like, okay, cool. But now let's bring it back to the guy who, like, has the addiction and see what we can do to help him. Because Sheridan doesn't really offer him any help. The most helpful thing that he does is he fires Garibaldi without making him feel bad.
Right. He suspends him until he works this whole thing out.
But he knows that, like, that's it.
Yeah.
Sheridan doesn't really think that he's going to get his job back.
Yeah, he calls it a suspension, then Garibaldi later tells Lockley, like, I know what this means. I'm not getting my job back.
And in the next episode, we'll talk about it when we talk about the next episode. But
yeah, yeah.
In the next episode, Garibaldi's like, well, I'm out of here. And we both knew I wasn't going to get that job back. And Sheridan was like, well, I hope you enjoy your life. It changes the subject.
Bye.
So I think that that's part of the reason that he's being kind to him is because, like, he's bringing the hammer down and laying down the consequences in other ways.
Yeah, it's, and again, like, Sheridan's intervention method versus Lockley's is really interesting. But before we get there, we do have another really good brief scene where Franklin is talking to Jakar in his quarters, yet again walking by like 100 people crying to go inside. I don't know why they don't just like slide through the door while it's open, like if they really wanted to get inside. It's really weird. I think they're still trying to be respectful a little bit. It's like, we're not going to invade you, but like, please come outside and talk to
us. They also might be vampires too.
You know? Oh, true. They're not invited in. You're absolutely right. It looked like Jakar was counting sand in this scene. He's just like holding sand, which
that
is
sounds,
like,
that sounds plausible.
That sounds like Jakar. And we learn what his whole struggle right now is, which is that he's being given the option to either go back to the Narn homeworld for good and lead his people, or give them his formal blessing so that they can lead themselves. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I don't want to do either of these things. Like, if I could just like if they can lead themselves in a way that doesn't require me to like give my blessing and treat it like you guys are only good because I said so, then that's what I want. I didn't want to be a messiah. This seems impossible. Like, I love it when characters acknowledge that, like, yep, I'm dealing with a conflict of interest right now. Like, there's no good answer here. Franklin wisely pointing out that a dilemma this difficult is probably just the higher powers, like, testing us because we test them all the time. Like, it's sort of a retribution because we make so many contradictions that, like, now this is the world telling us, like, yep, sometimes you don't get an answer.
Yeah, that was beautiful because Franklin's point is God is just mad that it's so hard to figure us out.
Yeah, we keep being weird.
Here's something you can't figure out because I can't figure out why you're jerks.
Right, right.
So you're going to be jerks to each other. That worldview is really fascinating.
I think it's it might be this episode where they talk about God. What is it? Like, with the problem that he can't solve, like, is he smart enough to make a problem?
That's this one. When Franklin says, you know, people have said, could God make a rock big enough he couldn't lift it?
Right.
And, like, the real question to ask is, could God make a problem so complicated he couldn't solve it?
Right, 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 right.
And Franklin says, like, well, that problem is us.
It's us. He made it.
So it's kind of beautiful. He fucks with us because he can't figure us out.
Right, 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 right. We then transition to our sort of weird C-plot that fleshes itself out in the second episode, but intertwines itself with Garibaldi's plot. Zach and Lockley get a call from home from a woman who's saying that the rogue telepaths are committing acts of terrorism all across Psycor. And they keep mentioning, remember Byron?
Yep.
Remember Byron, you guys? And I'm like, no, I don't remember him.
I forget.
I already, who is that? She mentions also that the money's being funneled via Babylon 5, and they're like, it's totally Leeta. We have to go talk to Leeta. Yeah. Later, they visit her in the Zocalo to take her to questioning. This scene is amazing! Where they go to her in the bar, and they're like, Leeta, you're under arrest. We know what you're doing with the money. We know you're, like, responsible for the terrorist attacks. Come with us quietly so we don't have to make a problem. And she's like, no, don't feel like it. And they're like, Leeta, we have guns. And she's like, cool. Cool. She's tapping her fingers on the table, and we realize that everybody else in the bar is also doing it because everybody is under her control at once.
Oh my god.
This is brilliant. And then they start like hitting their hands on the table in sync and like doing little like dun dun dun, and it's like so scary. And then it has to get really dumb. You mentioned that you did this part was hilarious. The pacing of it is so funny because that part's like, wow, very chilling. Lita, amazing telepath. And then they're like, why are you so strong? And she's like, you cannot stop someone who has been touched by Vorlons.
Yeah, and then some gaffer reaches his hand into the frame.
And goes,
some best boy.
And he's like, hello, it's me. Sheridan is like, I've also been touched by the Vorlons.
So stupid.
This is a weirdly cartoonish scene in a very serious episode.
Because it's cartoonish, and then also like it doesn't actually make sense. So Sheridan's saying that he's immune to telepaths.
Like what?
Is that like we're learning that right now?
I guess. I think so. Yeah. He's like, all right, you're under arrest, and then they finally get the guards back. And then just to make this scene a little bit sillier, Lockley punches Lita in the jaw. He just clocks her.
Yeah.
She's like, oh, you should have killed her, which is really, she's like, I know, she actually does say, like, I know this is really fucked up to say, but you probably should have killed her, and we're going to regret this later.
Yeah.
I'm sure they won't regret this later. Yes, they will.
I'm sure they will. I mean, Lita's going to go do the telepath war.
Yeah, exactly.
Turns out that's what the telepath war was Lita.
It wasn't this. It was, oh God, she's actually a nuke. We made a woman into a nuke.
Yeah.
Before the scene, though, there was that one of my favorite scenes of this episode, I think. Which is Lockley coming by to check on Garibaldi, doing the classic, like attempting to break through to an addict and saying, I understand your struggle. Like, I totally understand what you're up to. And I bet you're not going to believe me. And he's like, I don't believe you. I think you're full of shit. We always fight. I'm not supposed to like you.
Yeah.
She says the drinking gives a control freak like you an excuse to let go. Really just hammering home the fact that Garibaldi's alcoholism stems not from sort of self-loathing, but from the fact that he hasn't had control. He hasn't had the ability to order people around for a while since he lost his job, since he had the mind stuff in his head.
Mm-hmm. Since he was control, huh?
Since he was control, exactly.
Yeah, throwback to season 2. Throwback.
Rest in peace to... Tolly Winters. Gosh. And then he talks about the Asimov block later too, which I'm like, oh my god, this is all coming back. The saddest thing about Lockley's conversation here is that she talks about her father and how he had alcohol problems, and she says he was bad to us, but he never meant to be bad to us. He was bad to himself, because he never wanted to be in the military. He's just the character. If this is for the gamers out there, he's Ignatz from Fire Emblem Three Houses. He just wanted to be a painter. And the fact that he had to go to war meant that he never got to be a painter, and so he drank himself into a hole. It's very sad.
And Garibaldi's response to that was like, okay, fine. So you had an alcoholic dad.
Everyone
but you
does.
Still don't get it.
Yeah. She's like,
I never
cool,
seen
yeah.
you take a drink. And she's like, yeah, bud.
I have the same right. problem you do.
Of course. You haven't seen me do that.
I can't.
Yeah.
I had to force myself to stop. She says, children of alcoholics try to help everyone else or else they become alcoholics, basically. And she says, she tells him about Zoe. And she says, I had a friend. We used to do everything, smoke, snort, shoot, everything we could. And then she died. And then I got trapped in a cycle of life that I couldn't deal with anymore just to dig myself out of the hole of abuse and addiction. So don't pretend I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm curious as to why she didn't start by saying that.
It feels like she's wielding this information. Kind of, she's trying to use it strategically.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you don't just come in and be like, dude, I had a drug problem. Like, did you know that? She needs to, like, get there.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because she's stringing him along, too. She wants to talk to him until she gets something out of him. Because he leaves. He's like, get the hell out of my room. And she's like, no, I'm not done talking. And he's like, okay. He leaves. She follows him and just keeps talking about this stuff. Until finally he walks out. They like, stop talking. And it's just, like, this drawn out. Like, I am not going to let you keep hurting yourself anymore because someone needs to tell you that you're full of shit.
Yep. They get into an elevator.
Yep. Love it, an elevator. Check that off.
Uh-huh.
It's great that Babylon 5 still has like these little tent poles of scenes. If we get one more candle scene in the show, I'm going to be extremely happy. Speaking of like religious iconography.
Yeah, well, sleeping in light is just 45 minutes of someone asleep with candles lit.
Bro, if sleeping in light is Delenn and Sheridan finally get to have 8 hours of good sleep, oh my God. Yeah. I'll die. I'll be so happy, actually. They're like, yeah, we just had a good day and we decided to call it and not just sleep.
Yeah, we had some pancakes.
Yep. Oh my God.
It was nice.
Garibaldi later is talking that about Lita and says maybe her. He says something dumb that's like maybe she's powerful because she's angry, which is like correct but silly. He thanks Lockley, which I think was very, very big of him. He says, I appreciate you talking to me and thank you for like trying to get through to me. I still have a lot of work to do, but thanks. And then she's like, oh yeah, it's not just me. You thank yourself for inviting Lise onto the ship. Hi, Lise. I invited her for you. And she's like, yeah, he's like, Lise, what did I invite you for? And she's like, you know. And he's like, yeah, but tell me.
Like, what did I say? He's like, his cluelessness around how to keep this relationship alive is kind of startling.
Yeah, it's really, especially when he's like, we've known each other for like our most of our lives.
Yeah, like I never see you talk to her, Garibaldi. You always act as if like you don't want to see her. It's so
and
weird.
Then she comes on and you're like, I'm the happiest man alive. And you're like, what
is the nature of your relationship? Yeah, why didn't you just do this earlier? I don't know.
Well, he kicked her off because of the war, but it's like, right, he didn't tell her it was over. Like, it's presumably been over for a little bit. Like, what are you, come on.
Yeah, it's just strange.
Here's a plot that I thought was going to ruin the episode, but I thought was handled really well. We had an interlude where Delenn walks in on a very stressed out Franklin Sheridan going, bastards! Which is funny because Sheridan is like, everyone's acting out of character today. I don't know if this is one more person acts out of character and yells, I'm going to shoot myself in the head. And then she yells bastards. And then Franklin's like, I'll hand you the gun.
I thought that was dumb. That was, yeah. There were a bunch of moments of like kind of goofy comedic writing. Like, we'll talk about the second episode, but when number one or whatever her name was from Mars shows up and it's like, oh, hey, good. Yeah, he's here. Like, just a lot of cheesy lines. And I thought this moment was super cheesy. And then
this scene doesn't go anywhere by itself, though, too. She's just like, oh, the Kari are.
She just, comes in, screams bastards. The Kari are leaving, want to leave the Alliance. And then she like faints.
Yeah. She's stressed. I mean, I get it.
Yeah.
But it's a really strange way to end a scene. It's just like, basically what this comes back to is that later, Franklin announces to Sheridan the reason she fainted, the reason she's been acting weird, is she's pregnant. And he's like, but I thought the parts don't go in the parts. I thought I've just been nutting into a hole. And he's like,
you told me this couldn't happen. It's...
And Franklin's like, I told you it probably wouldn't happen. Yeah. No one's tested this before. Congratulations.
I'm just the doctor. I don't know anything. Because then when Sheridan's like, is she going to be okay? Franklin's like,
I don't know.
But I could have been wrong before.
50-50 chance. And then, it's really weird that they like actually address that they might need to have an abortion too.
Yeah, man. I love just the frankness of that where Franklin goes, do you want the child? And Sheridan doesn't react like, how could you ask that? He genuinely, sits with it and thinks about it, and he says, okay, if it's gonna kill her, no, I want her to be alive,
but ideally wouldn't it be cool if I had a son?
Yeah, that'd be sick.
Sheridan's a wife guy officially. I mean, he's been a wife guy for a while, but now he's like he's like a dad.
Yeah, I genuinely, in this episode, I'm finally like, okay, he loves Delenn. Because of the thing that you said about, like, he's calm now with Garibaldi because of her, and then this. It's like, okay.
Yeah. They're learning from each other. They're trying.
Forget my whatever crankiness about their relationship. It's back to being good.
Good. I'm glad.
It's just that they'll never tell each other about their deep, dark secrets or whatever.
Yeah, but now they're going to have a kid. They'll deal with it. Mm-hmm. They'll figure it out, hopefully. God, hopefully. Speaking of people figuring it out, Garibaldi is talking to Lise, finally having an earnest, honest conversation with someone, saying, I really just want to get my act together. I feel like such a failure. This scene hit me way harder than I expected it to.
Hmm.
Because Garibaldi talks about how part of the reason he's frustrated is because he's always wanted to have a normal life with Lise. He's wanted to give her the life she wants. He's like, I just want you to have something normal. And she tells him, there's no normal life, Michael. There's just life. Like, I too am someone who constantly looks forward to getting my life into a spot that I'm satisfied with, mm-hmm. but that can often come at the cost of your self-care and your self-worth and that, all of that, because you're like, oh, well, I'll be better someday. And that's like the mindset that he's in when he's talking to Lise, is like, I've made things difficult for you, but like maybe someday in the future, but not now, we can have a good life. Mm-hmm. And she's like, no, you can start literally right now. It's so beautiful and so good. And then it has to end with him being like, huh, company, eh? Because she says, like, if we can get together, then you can own my company. And he's like, oh, sweet. And then he goes, I'm going to kill two teeps with one stone, which, like, I totally think Garibaldi would say this, but that is a slur in this universe, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
It's just weird.
It's hard. I don't think it's, like, a slur, but I think it's, like, I don't know.
It's not a slur.
It's a thing people say, isn't it?
Sure.
They say teeps.
Yeah. And so he goes to Lita in prison.
Well, one thing that I thought was funny about the Lise scene,
yeah.
where she was like, whatever, like a normal life, we're not going to have that. And in my head, I'm like, remember a year ago when like my old husband was murdered by a telepath conspiracy?
That was weird.
Yeah, there's no normal in this world, bro.
And also when he's like, oh, which last name, like later when he proposes to her, he's like, oh, you're gonna be Lise Hampton Edgars Garibaldi, and she's like, last names don't matter, my old ex-husband is dead and I can take my last name, like what are you doing? Yeah. We have such a weird history now with each other. But yeah, he starts taking charge of his life. He says it's time to take control. He visits Lita in prison. He's like, I can get you a deal, but away from the cameras. And she's like, cool. And then just blinks and the cameras go boom, boom. Mm-hmm. I love every moment when people are like, I got you, Lita. I'll break those cuffs for you. And she's like, thanks. And then she just breaks the cuffs herself because she's like, who cares? His deal, and this is important because it's probably going to come back, is that he's going to use his connections with the company to offer Lise a brand new shadow fund for money if she removes the Asimov block from his brain that's preventing him from killing Bester. This is big. This is like, I messaged you, like, this seems like too much power for Garibaldi to have. Because Garibaldi's now in the role of a CEO, basically.
This was such an interesting choice in this episode, because everything's wrapping up and people are saying goodbye. And Garibaldi is leaving Babylon 5 to get into, like, deeper and deeper criminal shit.
Right, exactly.
This can only end badly for him.
Literally. You know?
Like, I don't feel good about him making this deal with the devil, essentially, with Lita.
Yeah.
I don't feel particularly good about what Lita's doing.
Nope.
Like, I don't like the Psi-Cor. That's true. And I think it's good that Lita's, like, blown up their stuff. But she's also, like, you know, fucking Dark Phoenix right now. Like,
yeah.
It's scary.
She's exactly Dark Phoenix.
And he says, no, it'll be cool. We'll just make a quick little deal. No problem.
Garibaldi, yeah. You're literally becoming a war profiteer. Like, or you're funding a war effort right now. Like, what's... It's all for something I think is relatively small. Because he's like, you're the only telepath powerful enough to remove the block. Which, like, yeah, I do think he wants to remove the block because, like you said, he wants to regain control. He wants to be able to kill Bester. But, like, okay, Bester dies. And now he's going to be replaced by someone worse. Like, you know that, dude.
Yeah. And Lita says, sure, I'll help you take your revenge. And Garibaldi says, it's not revenge. It's not what I'm doing.
No, stop.
Yeah, it is. It 100% is.
It super is, pal. What are you planning to do when you have that block out of your head? What's your goal?
Yeah, this is not Garibaldi taking control of his life. This is... him moving on would be him saying, like, I don't need to kill Bester.
Right.
I don't need to do that.
Block, if you accept that you don't need to kill him, then the block doesn't matter anymore. Like, he'll probably die in the fight with the Resistance.
Right.
And then you don't have to deal with it. You can go live a nice life and be like a rich-ass dude on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
He has a good life available to him, and he's like, no, I need to take one more person down with me. And that's what is, like, really frustrating about this. But this is, like, the plot that still has to be taken care of.
Right.
Obviously, he proposes the idea to Lockley, who is like, this seems like a terrible idea. Jakar walks in and says he's I don't know what to do. Despite all my best efforts, I have become an icon, which is hilarious. And he offers his proposition, which is that he will leave for parts unknown to find himself, kind of go on a little vision quest, and he would like to take Leto with him. Which, like, good plan, leads mm-hmm. to a great scene where they're like, let's go off together. I don't understand. I mean, I guess the reason she chooses to do it is she doesn't have a lot of options. It's the only way she can be freed.
She needs to go into hiding because right. the Psi-Corps is coming after her.
Right. So it's like, here's an option for you, but you can't lead your people anymore. You need to accept that. And you need to go, like, learn how to talk to people again. Because I think it's at the beginning of the second episode where he's like, do I think she should do it? And he talks to her and she's like so mean that he's like, yeah, you need to, like, relearn how to be a person, buddy. Which we learn later, she's not even a person, she's a bomb. So, like, oops.
Yeah. Was that this episode?
That's this episode, yes.
Yeah, that is so dumb.
Yes, it is. The oh show is, gosh. Like, clawing at dumb plot lines for the last drop, and I'm like, confused by it.
Yeah. Because Garibaldi says, the one thing he needs to know is, like, what's your psionic rating?
Yeah, why are you stronger than any other telepath right now?
Yeah, and she says, well... You know how there are small bombs?
Yeah.
And there are big bombs, like a thermonuclear bomb. And then he's like, wait, are you saying you're a nuke? I thought for sure he was going to say that. He said, like, you're saying you're a weapon of mass destruction?
Right. Very 1998. And then she literally, eyes go red, then eyes go white. And she turns to him and goes, pleased to meet you, Mr. Garibaldi.
So dumb.
Buddy, if this was a funny cartoon, she would turn around and look like the fat man. She would just be like, what's going on? I'm a nuke.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you. So she's a nuke. She's going to be a big problem. And now we are worried about her. Oops. Sheridan and Delenn finally get a chance to go to sleep. And the episode ends with him being like, I wonder what's going on with Londo. And he's probably having a great time. And Delenn's like, I don't know. And then, like we said earlier, we cut to Londo. And he's still alone. And still sad. They might as well be playing crickets during the scene. Like, come on.
Yeah.
No chance for our boy. Do you think he's going to get a redemption or something? Do you think he's going to get one more shot?
He has been redeemed. He is redeemed.
Oh, in that, like, how so?
He's redeemed for the things that he did wrong.
Right, but do you think he is going to live the rest of his life like this, sad and alone?
Yeah, I think redemption is a different thing than living in comfort.
True. Like, do you think he's going to get a happy ending is what I'm asking. Well, no, he can't.
No. I think he is redeemed.
Yeah.
And he is doomed.
The ultimate fate. Man, that's so sad.
Yeah, it's super sad. I mean, both he and J'Kar are completely redeemed, and
right.
their people are beyond
saving.
Help.
Yeah.
They're beyond saving, yeah.
Damn, that's very sad.
Yeah, it sucks.
Welcome to Babylon 5.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's where we're left off, as we're like, all right, let's get into the end game. Let's bounce, folks. Do you have any stray notes on this episode, man?
No, we pretty much covered it. And the other things I want to talk about, I'm realizing, are in the second episode, because they kind of bleed into each other a little bit.
Yeah, they definitely do. This whole back end is just like going and going and into itself. So before we talk about that, let's read some emails, yeah?
Let's do it. I love reading emails.
One of my favorite things to do in life is to read the emails.
Me too.
But John, if you want to take this email from Dan, we got some Dan mail.
Oh my gosh. Thank God. What's up, Dan?
Hi, Dan. It's a chunky one, actually. Yeah, I'm excited.
I love chunky Dan mails. It's been a minute, as they say.
They do. I hope you're doing well, Dan. I hope your winter is coming well and work is going well if you do work and family's going well if you do family and everything like that. I wish you well in all your things, Dan.
Yeah. This Movements of Fire and Shadow one?
Yes.
Okay. So here is a message from our buddy Dan. Dan says about Movements of Fire and Shadow and the Fall of Centauri Prime. Here's what I'll say about watching the Babylon 5 finale. So he's commenting on our discussion with Nick about whether we should just watch Sleeping in Light at the end of everything, which Alan and I think are now firmly against having started to wrap up the show.
As we watched these, we were like, no, you're not going to take that from me.
I almost just watched the rest of it last night.
Yeah.
Dan says, here's what I'll say about watching the B5 finale. Just watch it where it was supposed to be watched. Lining everything up into a nice chronological order makes for a tidy looking chart, but it doesn't make for the best viewing experience. I would argue that following a viewing order just based on where everything falls in the timeline can sometimes actually make for a worse viewing experience, particularly when it comes to viewing the finale. There's a lot to say for experiencing the show in the way that it was originally meant to be experienced, or at least how the original audience experienced it. In fact, I wouldn't even watch any movies before Sleeping in Light. Whoa. The chronology says to watch River of Souls and The Legend of the Rangers between episodes 21 and 22 of season 5, but I think that even that is a mistake. I would argue that the last three episodes leading up to Sleeping in Light are building a certain momentum toward the final episode, and it seems nonsensical to me to break that momentum to watch a couple of interesting movies. I'd say watch those after the finale, too. It's not like you'll be so confused to not know what's going on or how it fits into the chronology. Who reads a book up to its final chapter only to stop and read a couple of vaguely tangential side stories before getting back to that last chapter? If you can't tell, I have strong feelings about it.
Let's address that. So,
yeah, we want to talk about that right now, what our decision was.
I think we might as well. This is a good point to talk about it.
Yeah, so originally, the way that we had our viewing order, I think we consistently linked to this in our episode description. Is that right?
Correct.
And the original viewing order had us watching these two episodes that we watched this week. Then next week we would watch Objects at Rest, the episode 21, season 5. Then we would watch River of Souls. Yep. Then we would watch Legend of the Rangers. Then we would watch Sleeping in Light, the last episode of season 5. And then we close out season 5, do a recap, and then we do Call to Arms and Crusade. After thinking about it and reading Dan's email, what we've decided is to more or less realign our viewing order so that we watch things chronologically when they were released. So we're actually going to take Legend of the Rangers because it was released after Crusade. We're going to watch it after Crusade along with The Lost Tales. So that's going to be kind of a weird coda to our story. Technically River of Souls aired between the two episodes that we watched this week. Is that right?
Yes, it was November 8th of 98, so yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, so we're slightly off there, but what we're gonna do is we're gonna watch River of Souls next week, then we're gonna watch Objects at Rest, Sleeping in Light together.
Yep.
as a sob fest. Then we're going to recap season 5, then we'll do Call to Arms and Crusade, and then we'll do Legend of the Rangers, and then we'll do The Lost Tales, and that's how we're going to do it.
And then the heat death of the universe will happen.
Yeah, so we won't have any like back-to-back movies. River of Souls is going to slightly bump the momentum that Dan's talking about here, but I think because we're going to watch Objects at Rest and Sleeping in Light together, that's going to be fine, and that problem isn't really going to occur. So that's our solution, is we're just going to watch stuff around approximately when it was released and created. And that's going to be how it's going to be.
It's a really delicate thing to talk about when we're doing a TV podcast of like chronological versus release order. And I at least generally prefer release order just because, like, you know, we're adults and we know how plots can like fit around release order and how networks can interfere with stuff. So like, the early seasons of B5 were also aired in not according to the correct chronological order, and we managed fine because, like, most of that stuff is self-contained. And, you know, in most cases, I'm just like, okay, let's do release order. But if it means that we're breaking up, like, a really good swath of good episodes with, like, what I've heard are universally panned films, or at least, like, not beloved films at all, then I don't want to, like, ruin Sleeping in Light for us in the slightest.
Right.
Because ultimately our goal is to, like, get the right experience for that finale that people can enjoy to listen to and people will enjoy hearing us talk about. But also, you know, we don't want to make ourselves suffer after Sleeping in Light with, like, a bunch of bad movies that no longer matter because we're already mentally past Babylon 5. So
yeah.
That's why we're doing River of Souls next week. But we're doing just River of Souls, and then you're getting finale chats the week after that. So we appreciate people understanding, and apologies for, like, you know, saying one thing and then switching it up. But I think this is going to make overall for a much better end of the season.
Yeah, and then the other kind of
calendaring
thing that I think we mentioned, we've been talking about, but we want to, like, encourage people to reach out and give us your thoughts on this. When we watch Crusade, that is a case in which Crusade was aired in a wildly different order than its chronological order or its production order. And so that's a case where, like, Alan and I both have it on DVD.
Yep. Hell yeah. Shout out to Amazon.
That's what we decided to do. And we want to know, like, should we be watching the DVD order, which is the air order, or should we try to reconstruct the production order or the chronological order that, like, presumably JMS would say is the correct way to watch the show. So let us know what you think about that.
And we'll try to have that nailed down at least before a week or two before we start Crusade. If you want to, like, collect all those, to help us collect those results, twitter.com/chatspod, the pinned tweet right now should be a vote on whether or not we do broadcast order, chronological JMS order. As of this recording, we're at 4 votes and we're at 75% chronological order. So
okay,
I have a feeling that people are going to start leaning towards that more, just because, like, it's not a case where, like, oh, they aired it a little bit out of order. It's like, no, they aired it extremely out of order.
It's like episode 1 is either episode 1 or episode 12. Like,
right, that's exactly.
How different it is.
Yeah. So let us know what you think there, and we'll take that feedback into account.
Yeah. There's another paragraph in Dan's email. So,
hell yeah.
I'm going to read that. Dan continues, as for the Centauri capital still burning 17 years after the original Narn-Drazi attack, when I was watching the show originally, I assumed that those weren't the same fires, but rather that they were the result of continuing civil strife on Centauri Prime. But that's not quite right either. There's a book trilogy called The Legions of Fire that JMS considers to be mostly canon that actually explains a lot of the events that we know to unfold 17 years hence. The framing device is that it's a series of journal entries and notes created by Londo. It explains why everything's on fire. It explains how Jakar is on the planet in order to have the mutual strangling scene with Londo. It explains why Sheridan and Delenn are in a Centauri prison cell talking about the fate of their son. It explains how and why Veer ends up on the throne. We even learn quite a bit more about the governess watching over the children that Londo tells the In the Beginning story to. She's actually the daughter of Lord Rifa.
Ooh.
But an ally nonetheless. Yeah, that's kind of cool.
I think I read that in the credits or something, and I was like, wait, what? I was like, what does this have to do with Rifa or something? I saw that name, but yeah. That's awesome.
I'm wary about just laying it all out there and explaining exactly what happened, but the takeaway here should be that there's a legitimate reason that there are fires burning on Centauri Prime, and it's not a direct result of a Narn-Drazi attack from 17 years earlier.
That's good to know.
That's from Dan. Yeah. Dan bringing that up makes me realize that I do actually have a lot of questions about how we get to the Centauri future.
Like
why is Delenn? Why is Delenn there?
Yeah, you're gonna have to read
captured.
That book.
Yeah, but now I'm annoyed because this show has been so good about closing all of its loops.
I mean, maybe we'll get a little bit of that in, like, Sleeping in Light or something, and they'll be like, "Oh, we should go visit Londo." Uh oh. But they have a son at that point.
Yeah, I'm just... And then why does Delenn say don't go to Zahadum? Because, like, wasn't it important that he went to Zahadum? Isn't that how he got rid of the shadows? So why does she say that?
It's very weird.
And then, yeah, how does... Did Jakar and Londo choke each other in the beginning?
Yeah, I don't remember. I don't remember if it's in the beginning. I know it's in the beginning of the show.
I remember it happened in the flash forward Sheridan Unstuck in Time episode. So I guess that is still the future, right?
Right.
Jakar is there and Londo gets drunk and then they kill
each other to death. Yeah. I have no idea how much of this they're gonna get into. I don't want to find out, but I think we'll talk about this again, like any leftover plot threads, when we're done with the series.
Yeah.
At the very least.
That sounds good.
But that's our orders of business and a wonderful Dan mail. So thank you as always to Dan. We have one more email from our friend Nick. Just a fun bit of trivia. He says, FYI, our favorite bug boy, Nagrath, was on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. constantly reminding us that Buffy and Babylon 5 have more than a little bit of DNA inside of each other. Buffy season 1 episode 4, the student eating bug teacher was the same puppet as McGrath. That one really breaks my brain, because I imagine if I went back and watched it.
Oh, dude.
Yeah.
Man, I wish we had recordings of that. Oh, my God. What a trip that is to watch Buffy season one and to be like, oh, yeah, I guess this bug teacher episode is like what this show is. Cool show.
Cool.
And it's like, no, it's not.
Yeah, there was a whole episode where she was like flirting with the guys and then she would eat the kids. Yeah. Buffy season one is like one of the weirdest things.
Oh my God, man.
Everything about Buffy is one of the weirdest things. It's a vortex of strange, honestly.
Like, you know, the episode with if you're not jacked in, you're not alive.
Yeah, classic.
The, whatever it's called, the like demon in the computer.
iRobot Eugene?
Thank you. Oh my gosh, how could I forget? iRobot Eugene is like stupid. But it's
like
stupid 90s
dumb.
In a way where you're like, okay, yeah, exactly. This is 90s dumb and like, this is like the one horrible episode, but there's something about that bug teacher episode that's just, that's not, it's just wrong. It's not what the show is.
I mean, like season 4 has an episode where people are like stuck having sex in a dorm room for a whole episode. Like,
I
Buffy
guess
stays
right.
dumb.
I guess Buffy's dumb the whole time.
Yeah, but like sometimes it's extremely good and sometimes it's like the dumbest show on earth. Yeah.
Shit, we gotta rewatch. There's so much dumb stuff I forgot.
Oh yeah.
So much dumb stuff I forgot. I was listening to an old Chatsun episode where we ranked the Buffy seasons.
Wow.
And you like accused me of liking season 5 the most and I got so offended.
Oh my God, why? Why was that so
you
mean?
You said that I liked the Glory season.
I thought we kind of did like the Glory season. We thought it was better. That's because we tend to like skew away from the fan base as much as possible. And everyone was like, Glory's the worst objective season villain ever. And we were like, actually, she's fine. Like, she's problematic, but she's fine.
I never liked Glory. I always thought she was bad.
What's the... James was always cool. Thank you, Twin Peaks. he was. Nick concludes the fact that the human actress was also on B5. Whoa.
What?
The human actress playing the bug teacher was also on Babylon
5. Whoa!
She led the team in the tunnels on Mars. He says, is that an interesting fan theory, maybe?
Oh my God, that's funny.
Yeah.
Damn.
I love it. I love the endless connections. It fills me with life. What a weird thing. I mean, maybe she like knew people, but I also don't think... I mean, she's not the puppet person. She's not the McGrath puppet. That's just a weird, like, hey, we're looking for a big bug puppet. Hollywood, do you have anything? And they're like, yeah, we got this old thing from Buffy season 1. And they're like, bring it on over.
Wait, which one came first? Buffy season 1 came first or Babylon 5 came first?
Buffy season 1 definitely came first.
That's funny.
Buffy, hold on. Now you're making me doubt myself.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right.
I might be wrong, bud.
I think you're wrong, actually.
Wow. Thanks. Wow. What the fuck? Yeah. Fuck out of here. Sorry. Okay, first appearance of McGrath. McGrath. I actually have his page saved here.
Bookmarked.
Yeah, of course I do. Soul Hunter, season 1, episode 2. So that's February 1994. Buffy season 1 was 1997. Babylon 5 came first.
Wow.
They were like, cool. Yeah, the Babylon 5 set has some extra weird bug stuff. Do you guys want to use it for our evil teacher? We do. We do want to use that.
So this was like Babylon 5 was still on TV at
yes,
this point when Buffy 97? Started.
Yeah, that would have been like season 4.
What a time to be alive.
Seriously. You were alive. What? You were.
Yeah, I was. You're right. And it was a time.
It was. Yeah. Those are our emails for this week, folks. Thank you very much as we continue to dive into the swirling Hollywood vortex of using costumes everywhere.
Yeah.
We will be right back after this brief musical break to discuss objects in motion.
Welcome back to Chat Salon 5. The second episode we watched this week was Season 5, Episode 20, Objects in Motion. It was I was about to get kind of sad that this is the second to last time I'll say it was written by JMS and like mess up his name.
Yeah.
But the dude wrote Crusade too, huh? Yeah,
you're fine, man. You got plenty Hell of time yeah. to say this.
Oh, man. That's... Huh. I was going to have another sad moment, but we're good for now. It was written by J. Michael Straczynski. J. Michael Straczynski.
Wow.
Directed by Jesus Trevino. It aired November 11th, 1998. Oh my God, bro, this is spooky. Right now we're recording on November 13th.
2019.
On November 12th. Oh, this is really something spooky.
It's been 21 years.
Oh my God.
21 years since this episode aired.
This episode aired really close to my fifth birthday.
Yeah, you're old, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It takes place from September 1st to September 5th of 2262. Alan, what happened in Objects in Motion?
Well, Majal, as we accelerate towards the end, and I continue to lose my voice from this horrible hacking cough, I like to get really intimate with the listener and tell them that in this episode, people begin their preparations to leave Babylon 5. Jakarin lead Alexander to explore the stars. Garibaldi and Lys to take over Edgar's Industries on Mars. Do they intend for that to rhyme? I don't know. But before that happens, Number One comes aboard, bringing with her one last twist of fate. But John, what did you think of Objects in Motion?
I thought it was pretty cool. I think my impression of the Wheel of Fire was, what a delightful time sitting with all these character interactions. This is so beautiful.
Yeah.
And then Objects in Motion, it did this thing a couple times where it set up like, here's the plot that's going to take these characters into the sunset, and it's not going to be clean and it's not going to be pretty, but it's like,
it's going to be,
you can imagine what their life is going to be like.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm glad that Babylon 5 is doing that, but some of those, it's like, okay, you're kind of too neatly giving me the like, send off and set up of the rest of their lives. So I think my experience watching this was like, yeah, okay, that was good. I'm ready to watch like the actual end now.
Yeah, just like F me up already.
Yeah. What do you think?
It's a lot of goodbyes, and I agree that some of them, especially the stuff like Jakar and Lita, is like, well, we really need these like very, very complicated plots to just end nice and clean. And so we're just going to button them all up together, and we're going to call that a series. Like, it feels like it's just barreling towards a really clean end for some of them. Mm-hmm. But I think we've seen now with, like, Londo that the show doesn't always try to end in clean ends, you know? Sometimes it's just, like, this person has had their arc, and they've ended, and that's a sad thing. It doesn't have to be, like, and then they rode off into the sunset on a fun purple spaceship. It's like, yeah, maybe Garibaldi doesn't get over his alcoholism.
Well, and like we were saying in the first half, there's a difference between a clean ending and a happy ending.
Very right? true.
Like, Londo has the ending that Londo has, and it...
That's a clean
it's
ending.
It's done. Like, his story is over.
Yeah.
There's not more story that you need to tell. And it's a bummer and a half, but, like, ending Londo's story happily doesn't really feel like the right thing to do. The dude did, like, a big genocide.
Yeah, He doesn't get a happy ending. People like that don't always right. get a happy ending. I think, yeah, there's a lot of good plots in this episode. We do open on Number One joining the crew. She comes onto the ship and talks to Zach Allen. And she's like, it's me, Teresa Halloran. And I'm like, excuse me? Well, she says, like, Teresa Halloran. And then the show, everyone later calls her Tessa Halloran.
I think it was Tessa the whole time.
But I definitely rewatched that part. She says, like,
Teresa Halloran.
And I was like, is this just a funny misunderstanding of her name that they, like, guessed? Hmm. But I wrote her as Tessa in my notes for the rest of it. That makes more sense. She's looking for Mr. Garibaldi. We cut to him. And the way you know that this is almost a series finale is that somebody's having an alcohol detox. They're just trying to flush out he's basically trying to flush out 5 seasons of alcohol and stress out of his body with Lisa's help. He's just barfing into a bucket constantly. This is a perfect time for Number One and Franklin to walk in, the cutest couple of Babylon 5. And she tells him, as we end our cold open, that someone is going to try to kill him and Lys in the next few days before they can get to Mars.
So, like, she's so deadpan. And I think we said this when she was in the show before. But, like, everything that she says just feels one step out of the full suspended disbelief fiction of the show. She's just not, I don't know if it's like a character choice that the actor's making or if she's just not a very good actor.
Yeah.
But there's something about her that I'm like, what are you, this is so stilted and you're not performing with the level of like, I don't know, believability that the people around you are performing with. So what that ends up creating is this moment where her character goes, so you're going to die.
You're going to be killed? Like soon.
Yeah. So I just wanted to come by to say you're going to get killed. Bye.
I felt like the part where she brought the performance a little better was when she's talking to Franklin at the end of the episode and they're like, we're going to go have sex. We have an hour. Let's go. And she's like, check, please.
That was awesome. Well, the check, please part was stupid.
I mean, it's supposed to be a little bit.
But that scene was great.
Yeah, for sure. Chakar visits Leeta in her cell again, walking past a million of his biggest fans, just dropping more and more knowledge. She's like, I hate being in this cell. And are you okay, like, being in a jail cell? I know you were in one recently. And he says, it's a cell. I've gotten used to them. Frankly, I've done some of my best writings in places like this. And here, you cannot run from yourself. Which is so good.
Yeah.
Just nuggets. And wow. This is the part where I was like, I wish I could just have a book of Jakar quotes. And then I'm like, oh, shit. I want the book of Jakar. He has to leave because everybody wants him. But Leeta has to because nobody wants her. And she's like, huh, ironic, isn't it? And then he says some stuff about how we're all the sum of our tears. Too little on the ground is not fertile, blah, blah, blah. It's just that he just is piling on all the really good, like, little nuggets of wisdom. Basically saying that, like, we're all on equal footing at the end of the day. Just because these people want me and you think nobody wants you, like, doesn't mean anything. I don't like the read that Leeta is maybe doing all this stuff because she feels unloved. That's, like, not good. I would hope that she wants all these things because she truly herself believes that the telepaths deserve a better future and not like, I want someone to care about me or something, because that's dumb. But it's not entirely clear in this episode what that is. It's more like she needs help and Jakar is here to provide it.
Yeah, I don't think that she's like doing this for approval, but I think she has internalized that like she doesn't really have an ally in the world at this point. Like, the people who were her friends or treated her like that, at this point, nobody wants her around.
Right.
But I think that she's accurately reading the situation as it is.
Right. And they're like, he's like, yeah, we're going to go together. Like, I'm pretty sure we should do it. And she says, any idea of where we'll go? And he says, no, that's what makes it so exciting. Which, I'm already ready to weep, and this is one of those where I'm like, I didn't even think I cared about this pairing, and suddenly the show has convinced me that I do care about this pairing. He says you still have a lot of blocks in her mind as he walks out. Continuing the emotional sappy fest that is this episode, Lise and Garibaldi are getting married.
Yeah, that's nice.
That's exactly my response.
Garibaldi tells this to Sheridan. In the same conversation where he tells Sheridan, like, hey, I'm not coming back, and I knew I wasn't gonna get my job back, and Sheridan says, so yeah, anyway, cool, very cool.
Anything else going on?
Yeah. Sheridan's response of, are you sure you're not rushing into this, is like, bro, don't you know Garibaldi? Don't you know that they were in love?
And then he, like, needs an outlet, and, like, he wants to do this. Like, this is going to help him, hopefully. The whole reason he wants to do this is so that they can go live private lives. They're not going to be interrupted by anyone anymore, and he can just kind of work on himself and have and start a family, which I think is nice. I think that's, you know, honestly, that's what I thought season 4, episode 21 gave Garibaldi. But instead, they're like, no, he needed another season of stress and intrigue.
Yeah.
We're introduced to the assassin, who is like a weirdly charismatic old guy who stops a guard in an elevator, and he's like, oh, gee, this is so dumb. He's just like, oh, geez, thanks for holding the elevator, man. You never know who's going to come in these things. Maybe it's like someone who's going to hit the button earlier. Maybe it's someone who's going to stab you with a shank like I'm doing right now. Stab, stab, stab. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's like,
stupid.
This guy, I thought we were past dumb like hitmen on Babylon 5, but this is almost like a send up of those.
Oh my god, I just had a flash to the episode where there was like a dude who was going to blow up the station and Sheridan put a comm in his butt or something.
Yeah, hell yeah, I remember that one. Classic. Oh, I
totally forgot about that.
Best show. Top 10 shows. Tessa, our number one, visits Sheridan and she says, hey, we should open an, we should like you get some stuff going together. Like the independence movement needs a lot of help because Earth is like fighting back against us, even though we thought we won our independence. Like we thought we were done and they're not making it any easier for us. So we need something. Can you guys provide that? And he's like, I have an idea. He suggests that they should open an ISA embassy on Mars. I like that this is just going to work. I like that this isn't a big like problem. It's just like, yep, you can do that.
Yeah.
For once, Sheridan has something he can like contribute that doesn't feel like it's going to be controversial.
Well, it's going to be controversial, but it's not going to like explode.
True.
It's only controversial for humans. Everybody else is probably like,
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, whatever, sure. And it would have only been a problem also if Garibaldi at the end didn't do that awesome scene with the board meeting. Where yeah. He's like, you guys have to let Mars do whatever the hell they want. Mm-hmm. So she's stressing out about stuff. The killer is attempting to he stole his link. They make a whole big deal about like, oh my god, he stole the link. He replaced it with like one with like fake tape on it, and now he can access the security channels. This is scary. Why is it this easy to hack a link? Come on, guys. They're like, it's on an encrypted channel. He's like, I poked it with two soldering irons for 5 minutes, and now I can.
And I love Zach when he has the realization. This happens later, after Lise gets shot, I think. Uh-huh. But Zach is like looking at the ID and he's like, this means that this is a fake ID and he's has access to everything. And he's like fully explaining it. And then he says, that means that I need to leave right now. I gotta go.
It's like, you should have been gone like a minute ago, pal. What yeah, are you doing?
Shouldn't have bothered to explain a single thing.
Yeah, that I want to get there.
I guess that's before Lisa's shot. But
that yeah. scene where she's shot is absurd in a really fun way. Mm-hmm. Speaking of absurd, though, saying it breaks the fiction, but I'm really good at segues, Magellan.
You are.
Thank you. Jakar is really mad because this Narn comes up to him and is like, Jakar, can I get your autograph? I love you. I made these statues. And he's like, what? He's like, yeah, I made these statues for you and I'm giving them to everyone. He's like, oh, that's you. Cool. Can I get one of those? And he's like, yeah, for sure, Jakar. I love you, dude. Sign my tits. And then he takes a statue and throws it against the wall. And he goes,
no, he snaps says, it in half.
No, he breaks it. You're right. And then he says, go home.
What do you think of this moment? Because the guy says, the argument that they have is, Jakar says, like, I don't owe you anything. And the guy says, you owe us everything. We made you. Without us, you're nothing. And Jakar says, all right, I guess I'm nothing.
Oh, weird.
What do you make of this scene? Or what do you think about that? This idea of, like, the people we revere owe us something.
I think that it gets a little bit away from like religious worship and more into sort of
like celebrity.
Totally. Yeah. That was the read I had where it's just like, why aren't you the way we want you to be? Why aren't you the way you are in like my mind or in my books? Why aren't you helping us and supporting us the way we think you're supposed to? But he's like, I'm just a guy. I literally never asked for this. I wrote one book. I wrote most of it when I was like really racist and you know, I don't stand by any of it anymore. And I told you guys that and you don't believe me. So he's trapped. He's like, he's trapped by his own legacy, which is sort of the tragedy of him this season. He's like, I just need to get out of my own legacy. And realizing here that like people are going to keep building it as long as he stays because they're going to keep feeling like he owes them something. And this is like the last nail in the coffin of like, I need to get the hell out of Dodge because these people are going to keep doing stuff like this if I don't like firmly make it so they can't. Hmm. What about you?
Do you think this was JMS meeting his fans?
I do imagine that JMS is a pretty reserved guy. I think he's pretty like soft spoken. I think he's pretty soft spoken. I don't actually know that, but maybe, you know, you never know. I also don't think showrunners had as much like celebrity as they do these days when this show was airing.
But I bet he'd snap it in half if you brought him a JMS action figure.
Or yeah, probably. Or he'd just be like, please burn this. Mm-hmm. Like, I would not be flattered if someone was like, I'm such a big Chats fan, I made an Alan figure. I don't think I would. I would feel really uncomfortable. Yeah.
Yeah.
Please don't do that, guys. Thank you. I mean, do make fan art. I guess, like, what's the difference? But I just want to see me as Londo and Majan as Jakar, and that's what I want. But don't make a figure of us, please.
Yeah.
So Zach realizes what's going on, and then we get to the scene where it's Sheridan and Garibaldi and all the people up on a podium. I like that this room is small. I like that this is like a gigantic press conference, but the press room itself is like not that big. It just feels very intimate, which makes it really dumb that the hacker is just like walking around tapping his earpiece and Zach is like literally 5 inches away from him, like, where the hell is the hacker? I can't find him. Why do they also, why do they put one security officer on finding the assassin and not like snipers or like multiple guards? Like, it's just like, well, Zach couldn't find him, so.
Yeah, it just is a silly scene that culminates in more silliness because we stopped the guy, but then Jakar had the guy that was trying to kill him, and that causes a whole separate problem. I don't know. It just felt kind of goofy. And then Lise is the one who gets shot. And yeah,
several things happen at once. It's bad.
What'd you say?
I said several things happen at once and they're all bad.
Yeah. And when Lise gets shot, I had the reaction of, come on.
Come on.
Don't do that. If you kill Lise right now, I'll be so annoyed.
Yeah.
So I shouldn't have, but I looked up and I was like, does Lise die? She doesn't. Okay, good.
You didn't wait till the end of the episode, pal.
I couldn't because I just had no patience for it. Like, you're going to tank Garibaldi right now.
The final lap. Like, this is why I think these episodes succeed, actually, man, is they don't, like, Babylon 5 has been, like, characterized by its ability to give our characters what they want and then realize that they didn't actually want it or they shouldn't have wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, now in this final lap, they're like, no, they can get something that they wanted. Maybe it's not the thing they expected, but
yeah,
they're allowed a form of closure.
Right.
Like, if they were to kill Lise in the final act and be like, well, whoops, I mean, I guess Geralt just isn't happy, like, that would suck.
You know that if this plot had happened in season 3, Lise would have died.
For sure.
And it would have been so annoying. The, like, oh, push out of the way. Oh, whoa, bobo, my God, she got... Because... It's not even that she pushed Jakar out of the way. Who pushed Jakar? Was that Zach?
I immediately forgot this when I was watching it. I think Zach pushed Jakar out of the way, thus pushing everyone out of the way so that Lise had a direct line to the bullet. Yes.
It's just so... It's whatever.
Because they overload...
Fake dramatic tension.
There it is. Ding, ding, ding. Chat's original.
Yeah.
So they overload the hacker's earpiece, and while he's being apprehended, they're like, yay, we caught him. And then the Narn from earlier with the statues is like, you don't get to live anymore, Jakar. And he tries to shoot him, and then Lise takes a bullet. I love this next moment, though, where the reaction isn't like high tension, high anxiety. It's just Garibaldi being like, hey, Zach. And then he's like, yeah, Garibaldi, I know you're mad about the guy who tried to kill Lise. And he's like, no, not mad about him. About the other guy who originally was trying to kill me. I promise you, I'm not going to touch him, but you have to give me 5 minutes with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, Garibaldi, you're being crazy. And he's like, no, I'm not. I'm not going to touch him. It's going to be fine. We know that Garibaldi has connections. So he takes this guy into the prison cell with Lita Alexander, who he's like, Lita, do your thing. And she's like, no, I don't feel like it. And he's like, do the thing. And another chilling telepath moment. Where she's trying to read this guy's mind, but he is skilled in blocking telepath stuff. Mm-hmm. So she says he's singing songs, he's doing math. She's like, you forgot to carry the 7. There it is. Like, it feels like a live battle that you're watching.
Yeah, that was actually well done, I thought.
Yeah. I will always think about like how the show tries to portray telepathy in different ways. But like, I think this is a good moment of... we don't even need to see the guy's face that often to know that like he is trying to fight back. It's not like it's not the Vorlon shadow graphics from that Psycor episode.
Thank God, yeah.
And it's not two people squinting at each other. It's just him being like, I'm obviously doing this right now. She gets all the info from him, knocks him out, erases his memory. And she tells Garibaldi that the people who ordered the hit are the board. And he's like, thanks for the info. And then she's like, don't forget about your deal. And she reminds us something that I thought was interesting, which is our deal ends in 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So you have 2 years to get the money to put into a fund for me and keep it there and keep it protected. And then if it's not done, you're going to end up like that dude on the floor with your brain all mushy. Mm-hmm. And he's like, okay, that sounds good. So that basically confirms to us that like we're not necessarily going to see the end of that. Actually, we might, because Sleeping Light's later, right?
Yeah, we'll certainly know what happens.
Yeah, true. But not like right now.
Right. We probably won't see it happen.
Yes.
But we'll hear the
like aftermath of it.
Yeah.
In our next scene, Sheridan pushes once again past all of Jakar's worshippers and friends. And he's like, buddy, I'm going to miss you. You're going to leave Babylon 5. Don't you miss me? Jakar, again, being an idol and a person that I really wish I could be, saying, it's unnecessary that for you to miss me. He says, I believe that when we leave a place, part of it goes with us and part of us stays. After we're gone, our voices will linger in these walls as long as this place remains. Which just, the characters of Babylon 5 and their relationship to the physical station itself is so, it's commented on a lot in this episode. I think it's here, and then also like Delenn at the end being like, we've never walked the length of B5 before. It's really beautiful, like associating memory and people with a space. I mean, that's just a really like nice sort of philosophy.
I adored a couple of the moments in this this Sheridan Jakar farewell scene.
Yeah.
Because Jakar goes through this whole thing of like, it's fine, we won't miss each other. And then he's like, but the part of me that's leaving will miss the part of you that's staying behind.
Yes.
And then he's like, see you later, John. And in my head I go, is that the first time that he's called him John? And then Sheridan goes, is that the first time you've called me John?
Right.
I can't explain how satisfied I was that the characters pointed that out and had this adorable interaction where Jakar was like, no.
No, I've said no, it. Your name's John.
Come on. And Sheridan's like, I think it is.
Oh, winky winky.
It is so sweet.
It is these like wholesome, sweet moments full of like humanity and character that make all of the drama worth it. And I think that's like one of the things that's totally hard to describe when you're recommending a show like B5 to someone is like, yeah, the show will make you cry and it's really dark and it's sometimes corny and it mishandles its ideas a lot. But like at the end of the day, people are really nice to each other, like want to be nice to each other. And sometimes you remember that they're at the end of the day friends. And that's like beautiful. Because you get scenes like this, which are just so like holistically good.
Yeah.
He also dictates a letter for later delivery to his Babcom. Jakar does. Do we ever see what that letter is?
I don't remember. I don't think so.
We might have not seen that in this one.
Yeah.
Another wholesome scene though. Lys awakes to Garibaldi sleeping next to her, sleeping in light, if you will. He has a weird comment here where he says, oh man, you're dazed and delusional. This is a perfect time for me to do what I want with you. And I was like, no. And he's like, I'm going to propose to you. Just that, like, I totally know if I was like engaged to someone or wanted, or was about to pop the question, I could say something like that and it would be fine. But just the out of context phrasing of that, I was like, that's a really weird way to say that.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, will you marry me? She says, of course, you dumb idiot. And then another moment of beautiful humanity. The first doctor that walks by, he kisses him on the cheek like an Italian man. It's so cute. It's wholesome.
Yeah.
Be fine. They're going to get married.
That. Yeah. It's what a nice way for Garibaldi to end up, huh?
I'm a sucker for a good wedding episode, yeah. Meanwhile, at the docks, Lita. I always get Lisa and Lita mixed up in my notes, man. Lita is brought to Jakar as they get ready to leave. He's like, all right, you can take the cuffs off, folks. And then she's like, yes, I can. And then she breaks them. Again, just a lot of good Jakar lines. This is the moment where I was like, I need to stop writing down everything he says because it's just so good. Talking about, like, we're going to have great adventures together. We're going to get big snacks. We're going to go watch Netflix. It's going to be sick as hell. And then I think this part's handled well. I'm curious what you think. Zach Allen looks on forlornly from behind some crates, but then he walks away pretty quickly. Like he doesn't linger on that.
I thought it was exactly the amount that was necessary.
They did the linear plot better.
Yeah. There was no like zoom in and him going, none of that.
Sigh.
He doesn't try to pull her aside. Like the person that he had feelings for is completely gone.
Right. I mean, she's also a nuke exist. Now, so.
Yeah, she's a scary nuke. So it's really, there's no one for him to talk to about it. There's nothing for him to say. He doesn't really want to be near her. He's probably really scared of her. But he feels like he has to at least be present for her goodbye. And so I think that it's exactly right.
Right. It's just like, we are acknowledging that he had these feelings, but he is an adult who has control of his emotions, and he's not, this is not going to ruin his life. He's going to move on.
Yeah. And like, there's no one, the person that he may have shared those feelings with, is not a person anymore that he can talk to about it.
Yes. He's busy getting married. Assuming we're talking, well, I guess if assuming you're talking about Garibaldi.
No. I mean that Zach, like, can't talk to Lita about it.
Oh, because she's like, the person.
Right. Gotcha, but no, because she's, like, insane.
And she's a...
she's an insane, like, you know, mutant X-Men terrorist person now. The interaction that stuck out to me from this Jakar-Lita goodbye sequence is when Lita says, you're only hanging out with me because you want to make sure that the Narns get telepaths. And he was like, oh, Lita.
Oh, that old thing?
If that's why you think I'm here, you are sorely mistaken. And we've got so much time to fix that. And I really wanted his delivery to drip with a little bit more of the, like, sexual tension that was meant by that, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Jakar really is horny for this one. But he kind of, for once, I think Andreas Katsoulis undersold it, which is not something that he tends to do as an actor.
Well, it's this, like, not sexual, but, like, true glee that he gets in, like, oh, we have work to do. This is going to be so fun. Like, that is the part where I'm like, I really want to embody that aspect of Jakar, is, like, this thirst for, growth and adventure and all of that stuff. It's like, ooh, yes. And it does read as a little bit sexual, absolutely, especially because she's talking about the whole, like, DNA thing. But
and I really like the idea of Jakar thinking that it's his work to make Lita a better person.
Right, because he's like, we're going to do it together. It's not like it's his responsibility or else no one will do it. It's like, yeah, we're going to do it together.
Yeah, I don't know how that ends up working out for him and her, but I like that he's taking that on.
Maybe, like, a thousand years down the line, the Narn have telepaths again because they just make babies. Maybe it's not sexually fraught like that is. Maybe it's just like they go out and, like, go on, like, a whirlwind tour of the United States and try burgers in every single state. Wait, do you want to do that with me?
I do.
Yeah, okay, good.
I definitely do.
Check out our new podcast. Speaking of a new podcast, Garibaldi calls the board directors.
Oh, can I say something that's like a vague minor spoiler?
For B5?
Yeah. It's like a kind of like we always look to see if characters are going to come back kind of thing.
Uh-huh, they don't come back.
That's it for Lita. She's gone.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a good way for her to go, actually.
Yeah.
They
like stuff happens with her in some of the books. I'm like peeking at it now, but at this point, I'm not spoiling the show, right, guys?
I'm spoiling
the books that I probably won't read.
Oh, man.
Unless, should we read the books? I don't want to do a podcast about the books.
We don't have to read the books.
Okay.
We don't have to podcast the books. I'm going to read some of the books.
Yeah?
They're just like fun and silly.
If there's like a book, like I would do one.
To Dream in the City of Sorrows is the book you're thinking of.
That's the one?
Yep. It's the one written by GMS's ex-wife and it's canon.
What does it cover again?
I believe it's after something. I don't remember. Oh, 3 weeks after Sinclair's arrival on Minbar. So it's that.
Oh, okay.
That could be fun.
Why not?
Anyways, reminiscent of the newsroom, Garibaldi calls the board of directors on a big giant Skype call. And he's like, hey, idiots. What's the main guy's name? He's got like a funny name. Oh, Peretti. He's like, hey, Peretti, how you doing? I love these like rich, annoying people with their big gigantic wooden table, and they're like, yeah, so sorry to hear about the hitman. We did some research and his name is Gregory Fitch, which is a good name for an assassin. He's the head of security. He was the former head of security and he hanged himself last night. Garibaldi, isn't that terrible? And I mean, this is like just not necessarily from the headlines, but we all know, right? Jeffrey Epstein didn't kill himself, you guys. He did not.
Yeah,
he was killed as a cover-up, and so is Gregory Fitch. Absolutely.
You're right.
Garibaldi knows the entire board's personal secrets. He's like, basically Garibaldi is the Jeffrey Epstein of this moment, where he's like, yeah, you are like, your daughter's weird and your wife is like attractive and you're blah blah blah, and they're like, why do you know those things?
All of their things are that they're cheating on their wives.
Yes.
And then one of their things is that they did a murder together.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Sounds about right. And he's like, this pair of episodes is so good for out-of-frame comedy, because he's like, check out my new friend, the new head of intelligence for the ISA. And it's just, it's number one. She comes in, she's like, hi. And they're all freaked
out.
That
was dorky, but I was pretty into it.
Welcome to Babylon 5.
I couldn't think of a better character to replace Garibaldi as the head of covert intelligence.
Totally. Totally, yeah. Totally.
So good good job, James.
They figured it out.
That was a good one.
Basically, she's like, I'm going to skin you alive if it gets out that you're interfering in the independence movement again. Also, you all have to quit. And, buddy, this is all made 1,000 times funnier because we still, that iconic Daffy Duck poster, painting, excuse me, is behind all of this.
Mm-hmm.
So she leaves. She's like, fuck you guys, I'm out. And then he's like, by the way, and this part's awesome. He's like, here's a check. And I love that it doesn't look like a check because it's a sci-fi show and it like looks weird. And he's like, it's a 500,000 credit check. It's going to go to certain individuals. If me or Lise, you know, I don't know, fall down the stairs, get hanged in prison, unfortunately, you know, trip on a like a puddle, walk into a wall that has a hole drawn in the side of it. If any of those things happen and we don't die of natural causes, this money goes to some certain individuals, probably telepaths, and they're going to kill all of you. So, bye, we're going to be rich, bye. And then just, again, perfect, like, little capper. He's like, by the way, pretty, leave the cigars on your way out. I never thought of Garibaldi as a cigars guy, but I guess I'm not surprised, right?
Yeah, this, like, I don't know how to feel about this scene. Because it's like triumphant in the way that, you know, the hero of like a Tarantino movie is triumphant or something. Or,
like, well, if it's Tarantino, then that room would get gunned down. Like,
right. You're right.
But yeah, but it's that idea, it's that mood for sure.
Or like a Coen Brothers or I don't know, something like something that is just like a little more skew from reality and a little more dark than Babylon 5. It's kind of upsetting to see Garibaldi be the mastermind, like, I'm gonna murder all of you guy.
Right.
Yeah.
It's I think it's just because I have the newsroom on my brain now, it reminds me of like, also, we're not telling you anything. Also, we're getting married. Everyone come to our wedding. And it's like, what? The difference being that the newsroom never has any specific character to stick to, so it's never out of character because it's just always weird. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it is a strange cap. Speaking of strange, like Tessa and Franklin in the Zocalo bud, what? This like flirting is kind of cute.
Yeah.
It's adult flirting. She's like, hey, I really liked what we had on Mars. Did you? And he's like, yeah, I loved what we had on Mars. Also, the sex was amazing. Too bad we can't do it anymore because you're going to be intelligence and I'm going to be an international doctor. And she's like, yeah, that does suck. And he's like, you know what doesn't suck? I have an hour and a half. Do you want to? And then they do the classic thing that people always do in this scene where it's like, how long do you need? And he's like, an hour and 10 minutes or something like that. It's like,
well, she says, do you have less than an hour or more than an hour? And I wanted him to say, I just said I have an hour.
Now I have 58 minutes, Tessa. We've been talking for 2 minutes. Like,
let's
please.
Let's go.
And then, yeah, she's like, he's like, you take care of this. And she's like, okay, check, please. It's very silly. I'm happy that Franklin's happy, even though this isn't like he's not getting married happily. You know, he's just like has a nice sexual relationship with a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And we end on a really touching scene. Delenn's back from Minbar. If we every comment we've had about like Delenn and Sheridan's relationship feels weird. It feels like it has a lack of trust. All this stuff. This is a good moment. This is like, actually, these guys do like each other a lot. Sheridan's really sad because he says the gang is breaking up. He's basically doing the thing we're doing where he's like, it's the closest thing I've had to a family in a while. Oh, no, Garibaldi's the one who says that. He comes to visit them.
Oh, man.
Yeah, he says, all my family died and I pushed everyone else out of my life and you guys are the only people I've had that are close to a family anymore. I thought I was going to die face down in Brown Sector, but somehow I'm alive.
Brown Sector.
Not Gray 17.
No.
but Brown Sector. Earlier when he was on the elevator with Lockley, he said Green 2. And I was like, how many colors of thingies are there on Babylon 5? When he says goodbye to them and he hugs Delenn and then shakes Sheridan's hand, I was like, please, for the love of Christ, actually hug Sheridan. Don't just shake his hand like you're doing the masculinity thing. And then they hug, and I literally out loud was like, yes! I was so happy. And then, yeah, left alone, Delenn and Sheridan are having a tender moment. And she says, I've never actually walked the length of Babylon 5 end to end. And Sheridan's like, Delenn, you know, it's like 5 miles, pal. She's like, yeah. And he's like, she's like, you ready to go? And he's like, now? And then Majel, what does she say?
She says, now it's all we get. It's all we got.
Yeah, it's all we got. Now is all we have.
Oh.
It's beautiful. It's so cute.
I loved it. Yeah.
Is this redeeming the Sheridan Delenn relationship for you?
Yep. Yeah, we're good now. It's fine.
I'm happy.
You did it, everybody.
It's one of those things where it's like, yeah, no, like real relationships do have weird baggage, like all this trust stuff that they don't always address. And that's where we're left as we go into the final leg.
Yeah.
I'm going to be sad, Magellan. I'm going to cry. The friends are going to be done.
Yeah, man.
But it's been a good run, and you've inspired me. I'm going to try to listen back to some Chats on 5 episodes.
Do it. It's a good show. It's a good time.
This one everyone's listening to is good. Yeah, so John, tell the kids what we're watching next week on Chats on 5.
Well, as we talked about during our email segment, we're going to take a slight strange detour before we finish up season 5. And we're going to be watching one of the Babylon 5 TV movies that aired towards the end of season 5, as season 5 was airing. We are going to be watching the film River of Souls, which, you know, however you find it is how you find it. Is it on Prime Video? No, you have to pay for it, right? Yeah, it's on Prime Video, but it's not streaming with the subscription. You have to buy it separately. $2 if you want to do that, or I'm sure you have other ways to find it.
Mm-hmm.
This is the description. When an archaeologist brings a stolen relic to the space station Babylon 5, the Soul Hunters, an immortal race that captures and eternally imprisons souls, lays siege to the remote outpost.
Fuck me up, Soul Hunter time!
Yeah. So Soul Hunters are a thing from what, like season 1 or something?
Yeah, season 1, episode 3, I think.
Okay, awesome. Great.
Like extremely early season 1.
Awesome stuff.
Can you believe this is the same show where there was that episode with the virus and the Mega Man laser guy, and it was like Sinclair going in like, I'm gonna die, and then Garibaldi's like, don't throw your life away.
My god.
Same show, pal.
Oh my god.
Yep. Yeah, so we're gonna watch River of Souls. We're gonna try and get John's roommate Charlie on for that episode if we can.
Yeah.
Again, not apologies, but it's going to be a little strange breaking up the pacing of the season, but I want one more fun romp before we go into the sunset.
Yeah, I think that's legit.
Let's take it to the plug zone before I die. Hopefully no one's hearing any of these coughs, but I'm going to die. If you would like to email us questions, comments, or concerns, please do so by sending them to chatspot@gmail.com. You can also follow us at ChatsPod on Twitter, where you can find memes and updates about the show and all that sort of stuff. If you have voicemail comments as well, please send those as MP3 files to the email address, and we will play them on the mail segment. We would love it if you could rate us on iTunes or your podcast platform of choice, all that good stuff.
Oh, my God. Sorry. Oh, my God.
What's up, darling? You looked up something.
I'm looking at the cast of Soul Hunter.
Yeah?
Do you want to know who plays the Soul Hunter?
Wait, from that episode?
From the movie.
Oh, River of Souls? Yeah, who is it?
It's Martin Sheen.
Fuck out of here. Really?
It's Martin Sheen as
Ian McShane is in this movie?
Ian McShane is in it.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
In a 2004 interview with The Independent, McShane stated that he wished he turned down the role in River of Souls. What the fuck is this movie?
Oh my god.
Is this bad? It's probably bad.
Yeah, it's probably bad.
Great, 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 great. Cool. Well, get hyped for that. Get hyped for us being extremely disappointed. Probably. We're going to have a great time. And also check out patreon.com/chatspod, where we have all sorts of bonus content. We would love if you could help us reach our next stretch goal of $75 a month over there. We have plenty of bonus content to offer. On Thanksgiving, all of our patrons are going to be getting the first installment of Chat Snacks, which are little bits of audio that Majon and I have acquired and recorded over the years. Mm-hmm. Just little funny goofs and storytelling things and like stuff like that. Abandoned podcast pilots. And if we hit $75, then we're going to be doing what's called the 12 Days of Chatsmas, which is where we're going to put out 12 of those every day, starting on Christmas.
Yeah.
It's going to be super exciting. Tell your friends, get your Patreon numbers in there. Our highest tier is at $5 a month, which is really not a lot when you consider, like, I don't know, Disney Plus is like $7 a month, and that's got like five movies on it. Like, you can afford a Chats Patreon thing. Bro,
please don't make that comparison.
Yeah, we're basically the Disney Plus of podcast Patreons. No, that's unreasonable. But yeah, Majon, what's your Chatsum for this week?
My Chatsum for this week is a little show that watches Babylon 5 two episodes a week. It's called Chatsalon 5.
Oh, good idea.
I've been listening to it. I've been binging it from the beginning. Okay. And it's pretty good, man. These two friends, Alan and Magellan, it's just fun to listen to them, like, enjoy each other's company, and they make predictions that are, like, sometimes it's funny how right they are, and sometimes it's funny how wrong they are.
True.
Like, can you believe this? They were in season 3 when they got introduced to Marcus, one of the hosts, Magellan. He was, like, talking about Marcus and Zach Allen in the same breath as Warren Keffer, as if equivalent. It's like, you don't know what you're talking about, bro. They're about to finish up season 5 of Babylon 5, so...
Whoa, that timing is wild.
Yeah, so the timing is kind of uncanny, but I would definitely recommend giving them a listen.
I don't know. I feel like I have a lot of podcasts to listen to right now, but... I could use one more sci-fi pod, especially if it's like a competing Babylon 5 podcast. I'm willing to give them a listen. Like, why not?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's good to scope out like what other people are doing.
Totally, totally.
Well, Alan, what's your Chatsum for this week?
Thank you, sir. My Chatsum this week is a novel, a novella, actually. I don't know what led to me. Actually, I think I know. I was like reading some article that was like, what are some good books for people who are depressed? Just like on a whim, I was just like on a lark. I was like, that's a cute little thread to read. And somebody in there recommended The Little Prince by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. I'm sorry for butchering your last name, sir, but you're not alive anymore. I'd never read The Little Prince before. It's a work of classic French literature. Do you actually know what The Little Prince is about?
Not really, no.
Because what's interesting is it was, I always thought it was like a children's book. It's super not. Well, I mean, it kind of is. Like, it's about a child, but it's told from the perspective of the author being like, hey, when I was a kid, I like really wanted to get into art, but people never let me get into art because they thought that it wasn't a good career. So I stopped drawing and I lost that sense of childhood wonder. And then one day I was flying a plane and it crashed in the desert and I met this really nice boy who's, I call him the Little Prince, and he's like really lovable and he has like the childhood wonder in him still. Mm. And it's just like the two of them going on adventures and talking about stuff. And it's like super short and it's very adult, actually. Not like dark or like sexual or anything like that, but just it's a pretty philosophical text so far. And I think actually this guy's work was like banned for a while.
Hmm.
But this book came out in like the 40s, so it makes more sense back then. But yeah, I found like a ebook of it for literally 50 cents on Amazon. Like, you can just read The Little Prince. Mm-hmm. It's a super brief read. It gets the brain spinning. It's a good like bedtime read, actually, because all the chapters are like 3 pages long. So you just read a couple chapters and then call it a night.
Yeah.
I'm trying to like get more familiar with old literature that's not just American. So find yourself a good translation of The Little Prince and give that shit a read. Or just learn French.
Nice.
There's the one I'm reading. My French is not good. I think I actually hit 100 days on Duolingo today as of this recording. But
congrats, bro.
Thank you. But I'm at the point where I see like an English translation that seems kind of awkward, and I know I can guess what word they were going for, which is like a nice feel. But anyways, thank you very much, dear listener, for listening to this episode of Chatsalon 5. Peace.